Weight loss solutions are not one-size-fits-all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert-guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits started just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Here today with Nova Festival survivor, Eitan Halley. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show. Details are pinned in the comments below. On October 7th, 2023, Hamas and, quite frankly, thousands of Gazan civilians infiltrated Israel and committed the most horrifying massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. This is why the war in Gaza rages on and why it will until total victory. But even as we speak, massive online efforts are underway to whitewash, mitigate, deny, and even erase the atrocities that we all saw with our own two eyes, that we all know occurred on October 7th, 2023. Now, no matter what happens online, one thing is for sure. In real life, we have real people like Eitan who are here to tell us their testimony, to bear witness for all of us and to ensure that these memories do stay alive and do remain in the historical record. Eitan, you have survived a terror that I can't imagine 99.9% of the world could even fathom. So first of all, thank you for joining me. Thank you for your broader voice. And I can only guess that these conversations can't be easy for you. So what is it within you right now that is compelling you to travel the whole world to share your story?
Well, first, I want to say thank you for having me on this show. It's an honor to be here and to speak to as many people as possible, and every person that wants to hear me can. I think the main reason that I felt the responsibility to go travel the world and tell my story is because there's so much hatred and lies being spread these days all over the place. And unfortunately, so many people just believe it without really fact-checking it. And I am here today, and in general, going around the world to try and get my story of the Nova Festival out there. I am here to give a testimony to the world so they really know what happened.
I think the problem, Eitan, quite honestly, is anybody who is paying attention, which is not most people, realizes that we're living, quite honestly, in a post-factual society. And you are here to give us facts, and it seems like people are not willing to listen. What I find so frustrating is the people who are sitting on their couches who claim to know more about what happened on 10/7 than the people who experienced 10/7. They claim to know more about the perpetrators of these actions than the words of the perpetrators themselves. So in your efforts to spread the truth, and what I always see is, oh, but he's Jewish. Oh, but he's Israeli. Like, how can we trust that? Like, how do you respond to these ridiculous and quite frankly, anti-Semitic and anti-Western allegations?
Well, it's really easy to spread lies these days. Social media lets you post not everything, but a lot of things that aren't real or aren't true. And no one really fact checks these things before they go up online. So if I'm just a regular individual, a working class man or woman, and I decide to follow some influencer on Instagram per se, and I've been following for the last 3-4 years, and then October 7th happens, and he's just saying that it wasn't like we say it was, it's not true, or the things that we say that happened didn't really happen. And these individuals just believe it because they've been following him for so long. So it seems like it's really easy to spread lies these days. And unfortunately, we haven't been doing a good job in fighting the social media war and the propaganda. And that's a shame, but I hope that more individuals like I am doing will get out there and share their story.
So the question I keep asking, not just guests, but also myself, is are we really not fighting the propaganda war well, or are our numbers just too small? Because as we were discussing before the show, there's a lot of intimidation that is involved. And it's very sad. Sad is such a pathetic word. It's utterly tragic that the predominant narrative right now of the social justice warriors, right, the good people of the world, so to speak, is terrorism is justified resistance. And so we find ourselves against these forced narratives and bot farms and just loud people. And how, with our numbers and with the intimidation, because we're not intimidating anyone. We're not going out there and saying, if you support Hamas, we're going to kill you. We're going to find you. We're going to hunt you. And we're not hunting them down in the streets. I mean, there's the actual fact of, like, we're not just beating randos in the streets. So given those dynamics, are we losing the propaganda war, or is it at this point unwinnable?
It's not that it's not unwinnable. It's that we've created a strategy to fight an actual war in Israel. IDF has been ready for wars for a very long time. We're very used to being in war. Every couple months or year or two, Hamas decides to break the ceasefire and starts shooting rockets at Israeli civilians. And what happened ever since the 7th of October is we didn't even have a strategy to fight the social media war. So the people that the individuals that picked up the torch and said, I'm going to do this, it was by themselves. They weren't ready for this. And I feel like the other side was very well prepared. They had all their influencers I'm not sure how they got everything ready. But you can see that in universities all over the U.S., you have propaganda running wild, and Jewish students have been afraid for a while to go to school. And in my opinion, that's crazy. I feel like Jews in the U.S. are part of the backbone of the U.S. in general. And to get to a point where someone's afraid to go to school, well, that's scary. And I know that in Europe, it's even worse.
Yeah.
It's scary to walk around the street sometimes. If they know that you're Jewish, they may lynch you. It's a scary world out there. And I don't think that we can't win the social media or the propaganda war, but I do think that we need to strategize and start fighting it in a smart way.
Yeah. you talk about the propaganda being in place. I mean, there's not evidence. I mean, it just is that Susan for Justice in Palestine in Colombia went live after being dormant for months, 3 minutes before the attack. So we know how the Muslim Brotherhood is sort of behind the scenes working this whole propaganda war. And the truth is, and I just wrote this on my Substack, this war was never about killing the Jews. It was about delegitimizing not just the Jewish state, but all Jews on earth. And that is the fight that we are trying to fight. And it's not just the fact that this intimidation that you're talking about and bullying and harassment and attacks are happening. It's the fact that the people in charge are doing nothing about it.
I don't want to say they're doing nothing about it, but most definitely they're not doing enough. The fact that anti-Semitism is running wild these days, and it's in style to hate Jews and to talk bad things and horrible things about the Jewish people and our beliefs and who we are, well, that's crazy. I do feel like Judaism, Christians, and all that have some I don't want to say a moral compass, but they have good intentions all in all.
Yep.
And I really hope that we can change what's happening.
Yeah. Well, it's voices like yours that really do make a difference. And in my hope always in making these videos is that it's not just the people who want to hear it, but the people who have to hear it, who are willing to tune in and listen. So somebody's asking where we're from. I'm here in Los Angeles. You are from?
I live in Tel Aviv in Israel, and I'm in Los Angeles as well.
he's from Israel, despite the accent. So I want to talk about, let's get into the actual testimony so people can understand what happened on October 7th. And I hope that when they understand how atrocious and barbaric and savage these attacks were, that they understand that this war in Gaza is justified. It would be like if America did nothing after 9/11, or just did a little bit, and then the world was like, okay, that's enough. We're going to keep the state, and we're going to give it to Tijuana so they could be right on your border. And people just don't understand these dynamics. So before we get into your experience, let's explain to people what is the new Nova Festival, what's the vibe, who participates, and when you got there, what did you see? Let's set the stage.
So the Nova Festival was originally in Brazil. So it's this international, very big festival. People come from all over the world, and they started doing it in different places. And one of the places was Israel. Now, the general vibe of the Nova Festival is peace, love, and happiness. People come from all over the world just to celebrate life, pretty much, and just to embrace everyone. And that's what was happening at the Nova Festival. I arrived there with a few of my friends. I think it was about midnight. And as we go in, we walk around and we see everyone's very well dressed. Everyone has a smile on their face and they're all just radiating love. Now, everything was beautiful there. You had a very big main stage and then a few side stages. And there were a bunch of venues in the middle, artsy stuff and a little bit of yoga and stuff like that. And one of the things that was very, very out there that you could see is that there were all kinds of people there. There were people from all over the world, and it was just beautiful. It was amazing. It was just getting there and going in. You could feel the good energy.
So, for anybody who has not seen the documentary that you're featured very heavily in, We Will Dance Again, I do recommend seeing it. It's on Paramount Plus. It actually opens with your testimony. And the reason I say that is because, I mean, my hair stands on end when I start talking about these things, but when you see it, it's different than just hearing words. And of course, seeing it is different from actually being there. And so thinking about how much these conversations affect me personally, how much watching the footage affects me personally, before we go on, how do these conversations that you keep having, whether it's a talk in front of a group of people, a podcast, a show, how does having these conversations over and over and to some extent reliving those moments, going back to that place, seeing the festival, how is this process affecting you?
This has been a very long process. The documentary that I took part in by Yariv Moser and is an Emmy-winning a documentary, We Will Dance Again, it's a testimony. Not only mine, but other survivors as well. And you can hear our story, you can see it from our eyes, from videos that we took on the 7th of October, and you can also see it from the terrorist side. They had body cameras on them and they were walking around and filming everything that they were doing. And that is the most confusing thing, because our stories align, Hamas's stories and Israeli civilians. We went through something and you could see it up from both sides. And I think at some point in the movie, I say that you could see the terrorist smiling and happy, and then you see their body cams and you see them actually smiling and happy and laughing, and it looks like they're enjoying it in some way, which is horrible. I don't understand how someone can enjoy murdering, raping, and just doing the horrible atrocities that they did that day. And after the Nova Festival, I decided I was gonna try to put this whole thing behind me. I thought that by getting back to the life that I wanted before October 7th, I could move on. So I started working as a software engineer. And about a month after I started working, Yariv contacted me, or one of his, someone from the movie contacted me and asked me if I want to come and interview myself. I came in, I did an interview with Yariv, and then I forgot about the movie, and I didn't think about it for about 8 months. Then one day Yariv sends me a message and asks and tells me, "Listen, Paramount Plus bought the movie. We want to screen it all over the world. We want to fly you out to New York and LA for a few premieres, and we want you to get on stage and answer some questions." Now, at that time, I felt like I wasn't in the correct place. I felt like working as a software engineer while everything was going on, the propaganda war and the war in Gaza and in Lebanon and everywhere, in fact, just working as a software engineer wasn't the correct thing at the time. So I fly out with Yariv, and we go to New York and LA, and I get on stage and I start talking, and all of a sudden I can talk in front of a big crowd, and we're talking about like 100 to 200 people. I was never able to actually get on stage and talk like that. I've never had the talent. I wasn't blessed, I guess, up till the 7th of October, and then something changed. And that's when it hit me. I cannot say why the others didn't survive, but I know why I did. I survived to give this testimony to the world.
Amazing. Amazing. And having that divine sense of purpose, I think, changes everything. It changes everything of how you approach life, how you go through life. I want to get back to this, but let's talk about the actual experience. And again, getting back to the concept of post-factualism, the fact that your story and Hamas's story lined up, but again, that the armchair, you know, viewers are like, no, we know better, and nobody would ever do that, and these are the good guys, and it's like, yeah, no, like, here's the proof, here's the evidence. We gotta get the right people to watch it. So you arrive in the middle of the night, and the big high point of the festival is when the sun rises in the morning. Everybody anxiously awaits to be able to see each other's faces and who are they celebrating life with. And when I hear people talking about the buildup to this moment, and feel free to discuss that, the sun begins to rise. It's 6:29 a.m. And what happens at that point?
So, like you said, when the sun rises at festival, it's the most magical moment. You begin to see everyone's faces, and you just feel this energy, this high lifted energy in the air. It's mesmerizing. You really can't understand it until you're actually there. So, a few friends and I start walking towards the main stage. We felt the beat of the music in our chest as we get closer, when suddenly the music stops. Everything cuts off. Confused, I look around and I see everyone pointing their phones at the sky. I turn and I look and I see a massive barrage of rockets being fired from Gaza just a short distance away. The Iron Dome fires back, intercepting as many rockets as it can, exploding mid-air. Now, for those of you who don't know what the Iron Dome is, it's this protective system that Israel has. And the reason that we need it, and it's essential for our living and our existence, is because Hamas shoots so many rockets at us. And if we didn't have it, we would have rockets falling all over Israel every couple months or year. And we would have casualties in the hundreds, if not thousands. So we developed this system to protect us. Now, I know that sounds crazy, the thought of having an Iron Dome. It's hard to explain to people. Try to think about walking down the street one day, and then sirens go off, and you have to run, and you have about anywhere from a minute to 2 minutes to run to a protective area. And if you don't, then a rocket can fall. Now in Israel, because of the Iron Dome, the chances that the rockets will land and hit are close to zero. But the Iron Dome does intercept the midair, meaning there's shrap metal that falls. And I've seen pieces of huge tubes falling out of the sky and just landing in the middle of the street. Now, if one of those things lands on you, you're not going to survive. And that's scary, the thought that I have to live my regular life with all the stress that I have or don't have, and then out of nowhere, rockets could be fired at me. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's crazy that people in the Western world see it happening in Israel and go, oh, okay, whatever. That's Israel. Like, they're the lack of empathy, the lack of being able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, and to understand, for example, Hezbollah started their rocket fire on October 8th. Israel, took 9,000 rockets before the beeper attack, right? Yeah. And people don't understand that Israel will literally absorb thousands, not one. Like, imagine one rocket from Mexico to Texas. It would be the end of Mexico. Mexico would be a parking lot. Israel takes thousands of rockets because the world is like, wait, hold on. Hold on, Jews. Wait a little longer. Wait. Okay, now. And it gets to the point where, first of all, Hamas has broken every ceasefire. People do not understand this, that regardless of the color of their skin, and even though you are Caucasian, more than 50% of Israel is people of color, but never mind that. Even though everyone perceives them as this oppressed class, they are a terrorist state. You can say what you want about the people. They're radicalized, but it doesn't matter. The government the actual government is a terrorist government, and the people of Israel need to live under that constant threat. So it's 6:29 a.m. The first thing you see are rockets. You've seen them before. What are you thinking?
So in Israel, we're very used to this, the rocket of Hamas breaking the ceasefire and firing rockets at us. And to be honest, I was sad that they stopped the music. I was frustrated that the festival was over, which I didn't know at that time. I thought that maybe this is just going to be a 20-minute to an hour attack, and then we can go back to our lives and go back to partying. Mm-hmm. Now, that is the mentality of Israelis. That's mm-hmm. the way they work. The rockets go off. There's sirens. You go to a protective area. You stand there for about 10, 20, 30 minutes, however long you need to, and then you go back to your regular life. And that's crazy. Saying it out loud, it just sounds insane. But that's the way things are in Israel, and there's nothing you can do about it. So I've lived through rocket fire before, so I wasn't really feeling any immediate threat. Like, I knew there was a chance, a small chance, that a rocket would fall near us or shrapnel. So I tried to stay calm. I took my friends to an area under a few trees that wouldn't have helped if anything would have fell anywhere near us. But it was just an illusion for ourselves. And I tried to help my friends to calm down and not feel like they were in some immediate threat. And I think it was about 20 minutes to 30 minutes, and then a security guard and a policeman walk up to us and say, "Listen, guys, the music isn't going to continue. The dancing isn't going to return. You guys have to leave now. It's too dangerous here." So reluctantly, we pack up our stuff and we start walking towards our vehicles.
I'm curious, Eitan, because I've heard your story a few times. However, what I don't hear is, did you see any terrorists? Did you encounter what some of us have seen, what happened on the actual festival grounds? And people have to understand, these festival grounds, I've been there. Hopefully everybody takes the time to get to Israel and to see these locations where these atrocities happened. But it's in the middle of nowhere. When you say you went under a tree, I mean, there's nowhere else to go. I mean, like, you're just, so I know a lot of people personally encountered the terrorists in the most horrific ways face to face. Did you see any terrorists before you left the grounds?
So from my understanding, at 6:30, when the rockets started going off, there were Hamas terrorists that have invaded Israel in the hundreds. At that time, they didn't make it to the festival area yet, but they were on their way. And I'm not sure exactly why they didn't reach there yet. I'm assuming because their vehicles didn't move fast enough, or they weren't able to get there. But from my understanding, they were already on the road that was right outside of the festival. Now, three friends and I get into our car, and we start driving. And we try to go out where we came in from. And there was just like a crazy jam there. We couldn't really move. We were just stuck. And I remember just sitting in the back seat and looking outside and seeing rockets going off all over the place. And people running, and I remember people were still smiling at that point. They were still intoxicated, under the influence of something, and just running all over the place. And again, no one knew that they were terrorists. But from my understanding, at that point, everyone who was able to get to the road and take a left to go north towards Tel Aviv, where most of the people were going, encountered the terrorists, and they were waiting for them at that point. And that's what created the traffic. So we're sitting there and we're not moving and we're very frustrated. And then someone yells, "There's an exit on the other side." So we turn around and we start driving to there. and we hit another traffic jam, and we're stuck there for another 10 minutes. And then at that point, we're fed up. We had a 4x4, so we go off to the fields and drive around everyone, and we get to the road.
Wait, I'm sorry, really quickly. Are these the fields that we see the videos of everybody running away?
Yeah.
So you were driving through these people who were running?
It was a little bit chaotic. At the time, No one was running through the fields because there were no terrorists at the Nova Festival area.
Okay.
So everyone was still in their cars or trying to figure out how to get home in some other way, in a vehicle, not by foot. Again, there was no immediate threat.
And okay.
It's funny saying that because there's rockets going off all over the place, which is an immediate threat. But living in Israel for a while, it's not exactly that. So we get to the road, and everyone's taking a left, no one's moving, and we take a right. And we hit the gas, and we go as fast as we can. And it was a few minutes, and we start passing Kibbutz Re'im, and the sirens start going off. Now, in this area of Israel, when you hear sirens go off, they teach you at school from a young age to stop on the side of the road, get out of the car and go to any protective area that is around you. And if there isn't one, just lie down on the ground and get away from the car. Because if something hits the car, there's going to be a bigger explosion. And so we're driving and we see this concrete shelter on the side of the road. The sirens are going off. And I tell my friend, stop on the side. So we pull up, we hop out of the car and we run in. And we walk into this concrete shelter, which is there for the exact reason that we ran there for, to get out of the rocket fire.
And what happened when you got there? Did you feel like you were safe? Did you feel like sort of when the alarms went off at first or the music stopped and you're like, okay, well, I mean, this sort of sucks. When you arrived there, were you like, okay, now, you know, we'll wait this out. We'll just hang out. Everything will be fine. We'll go home. Maybe we'll hang out. You know, like the festival's ruined. The day doesn't have to be ruined. Or were you like, now what?
So these concrete shelters don't have doors. They're not safe rooms. They're there just to protect you from shrapnel. If a rocket falls anywhere in your area, you'll be safe. If it's a direct hit, I think there's like a 90% chance that you won't make it. So we run in and there's already 15 people in there.
And what's a normal capacity for a shelter like that?
I think anywhere between 5 to 10 people, 10 at the max.
Okay.
So we're 15 people in there and it's just packed. But we walk in and we're still like, we're pretty calm. We're generally calm. And we start talking to people and we're just laughing and having a good time. Again, we didn't know that there were terrorists in Israel at that time. So we felt pretty good. And we decided we're just going to wait it out. And the second the rocket attack is over, which we thought would be anywhere between half an hour to hour max, and as we're standing in there, more and more people come in until at one point, Anel Shapira and Hirsch Goldberg, Poland, walk in. Now, Anel was an off-duty soldier, and he had this commander's vibe to him. Just very stern, direct, and with a loud voice, he said, "Terrorists have invaded Israel, but there's no reason to fear. My guys are stationed half an hour away. The IDF is taking care of this. Everyone stay calm, and I'll keep you updated." Now, at this point, my mind is racing. I can't comprehend what he just said. Terrorists have invaded Israel, but the IDF has the best intelligence in the Middle East. We're strong. Our borders are strong. Hamas, they're nothing. They can't invade Israel. They're just a group of terrorists. And then a few minutes go by, and as this time is going by, I'm thinking to myself, maybe I should grab my friends and leave and get in the car and just drive away or even run away. But then a couple comes in, and they say, We kept on driving down the road where I was supposed to go, just a few minutes away. Terrorists had shot at their car. They had to turn around and come back. Their car is dead outside. This is the only safe place to be. The terrorists are going to be here in a few minutes.
Unimaginable. I mean, my heart starts pounding. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay. If at any point you need to take a break or, you know, step back, just let me know. And I do want to always make sure to stay as sensitive as possible to reliving this experience. To the extent that you feel comfortable talking about what you were experiencing, please feel free. If it's more comfortable to just talk about what actually happened as sort of a third party observer, please feel free. And if it's too much, let me know.
I'm here to give my testimony. This isn't easy. This is difficult, but I realize how important this is. And I'm okay taking this toll on me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what happened? What were you thinking, if you were feeling, or do you just want to talk about what unfolded at that moment?
I was just in total disbelief. I thought I was in a nightmare. I couldn't understand that this was what actually was happening. But a moment later, we hear trucks pull up, and we hear screaming in Arabic. And the concrete shelter is built in a way where you have this small hallway in, and then you have to take a left to get to the protective area. Anil was standing at the entrance of the protective area, so he could look outside, but he didn't see everything. And he says, trucks have pulled up, terrorists are dispatching, they have bulletproof vests, AK-47s, and RPGs. This is it, guys. We're gonna have to fight. Now at this point, I don't even know what to think. I'm just standing there in total shock. And then the terrorists start screaming to come out, and they open fire at the entrance. Now again, there's a hallway in, so they're not shooting at us. They're just shooting at the wall, just to scare us. I think at that time, or I think that's their training. That's the way they train for these kind of situations. They were ready for everything. They knew exactly what they were doing. And they start firing. Now there was a Muslim man in the shelter with us.
Mm-hmm.
And he screams out and he tells us, I'm gonna go outside, I'm gonna talk to them, I'm gonna try to reason with these terrorists.
Right.
And he yells out, I'm Muslim, don't shoot, I'm coming out.
Right.
He walks outside and he never comes back. We later learned that they brutally beat him to death. They didn't show him any mercy. I've seen videos from outside of the shelter, and you can see them just kicking him and doing horrible things. And then they opened fire at the entrance again. And that's when they rolled in the first grenade. I didn't know that there was a grenade there at the time. Anil just reaches down, picks it up, and throws it out. And then he turns to everyone and he says, the terrorists have started throwing grenades. If you see one, pick it up and throw it out, or point it out for someone to throw out. And I'm thinking to myself, what? Did he just say they're throwing grenades at us? I've never been in this kind of situation. I was in the military for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was all over Israel. In Operation Protective Edge, I was in Gaza for a few days. And that's when I really understood the mentality of Hamas and the mentality of the Jewish people and how loving and caring we are and how they're just full of hatred. So he throws out the first grenade and he says what he says. I'm in shock, but I snap out of it, I pull out my phone, and I call the police.
Mm-hmm.
I tell them, we're outside of Kibbutz Re'im in a concrete shelter, which is also called a migunit. There are terrorists outside. They're firing at us. and they're throwing grenades. If you guys don't get here immediately, someone's gonna die. And they keep on asking me these general questions. Are you safe? Can you hide? What do you see? I couldn't understand why they weren't being more more of help, why they weren't doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I think they were also in total shock. They didn't understand what was happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm standing there with the police on the phone, and all of a sudden there's an explosion at the entrance. I feel something sharp hit my hand. I look down and I see that the screen on my phone's cracked. I try to hang up and I realize that the phone's broken. Mm-hmm. At that moment, I drop my phone. I gather my strength and I realize that if I don't fight, I'm not gonna walk out of here alive. I'm standing right next to Anil at the entrance and they keep on throwing in grenades and I'm doing whatever I can to help him. I'm trying to point them out and he just keeps on picking them up and throwing them out. And he's doing this for like a few minutes. I think it was after the third or fourth or fifth grenade, I was thinking to myself, wow, this kid's a superhero.
Yeah.
A 22-year-old, 21 or 22-year-old just standing at the entrance and protecting all of us.
Right.
In a way, he was our guardian angel, just standing there and taking full responsibility. And one of the things that's going through my mind is, wow, what he's doing is extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
I think there's a chance that something might happen to him. And if he doesn't make it, someone's going to have to continue what he started. Now, I'm standing right next to him, and I know that if I don't make it, then I don't know what's going to happen. But I know that if something happens to him and I survive, I'm going to have to continue. And then I think it was either the seventh or eighth grenade, and there was an explosion. Now, till this day, I'm not sure if it was a grenade or if they shot an RPG in, because they had zero success with the grenades in the beginning.
Right.
But there was a massive explosion at the entrance. I go flying back, bash my head on the wall, someone lands on me, and I pass out for the first time. I open my eyes a few seconds later and I see Hirsch sitting there. His hand was blown clean off. A piece of bone was sticking out. He wasn't scared. He was mostly confused. And as he says, I don't have a hand, I don't have a hand, he's tying off his wound to stop the bleeding so he doesn't lose too much blood and die. And then someone says, there's a dead guy over here. I look over. It was Anil. He gave his life to protect ours, total strangers. And then I realize I'm standing exactly where he was moments before. And I know that the next grenade that lands at my feet, I'm gonna have to pick up and throw. And then I hear this clinging noise and see this grenade land at my feet. And I see a flame a few inches tall coming out of the top of it. And it's getting shorter and shorter. And I know that if this flame goes out, the grenade will go off, kill me and everyone else that's at the entrance, and the terrorist will get in. I don't remember how I threw out all three grenades. I remember the first one and the last one. What happened with the last one was the terrorists came to the conclusion that if they throw more than one grenade at a time, they may have some success. And that's what they did. They opened fire at the entrance so no one could pop up their head and see them coming. One of them came really close, threw a grenade that bounced off the wall and landed deep in the crowd of people. And then they rolled another one at the entrance. I pick up the one at my feet at the entrance, throw it out. I turn around and start yelling, grenade, grenade. and it went off. I feel this powerful force lift me off my feet, throw me against the wall. I bash my head for a second time. Someone lands on me and I pass out. At this point, I was out for a few minutes. When I was finally able to open my eyes just for a second to see what was happening, I glanced at the entrance I was hoping that we were still in this war and someone continued what Anil started, and it wasn't just me taking the responsibility. But it was too late. Everyone that was able to help was already injured. Now, from my understanding, Hirsch lost his hand from picking up a grenade and then throwing it out too late, and the blast was too close to him. At this time, I think it was passed out. So I'm looking at the entrance, and I see that there's a few dead people there. Everyone else is either passed out or just sitting in pain from their injuries of the shrapnel. And then I see a Hamas terrorist walk in, and he's smiling like he won some kind of game. Like what they were doing was a game, or I couldn't understand why he was so happy. He just killed people. He just murdered people. He points his gun at Hirsch, who starts getting up, and I close my eyes again and pass out. Moments later, one of the terrorists stands over me, grabs me by my head, and starts shaking to see if I'm alive. I don't know why till this day, but they left me there to die. I was later informed that the terrorists came in, kidnapped 5 people, loaded them onto their trucks, came back, stood at the entrance, and started screaming Allahu Akbar while they unloaded their magazines into my innocent friends while they were begging for their lives. And then they left. I was out for a few more minutes. When I was finally able to open my eyes again, I realized that I was lying in a pile of bodies. At this point, I didn't really know how severe my injuries were. Mm-hmm. Both my eardrums erupted from the explosions, and I start patting down my body. I start checking my arms, my hands, my face, my ears, down to my chest, and I go down to my legs. I couldn't feel my legs at the time because I was covered in bodies. And I was able to pull my legs out, and when I saw that they were still there and I felt them, I had this kind of relief because I just saw someone lose his hand a second ago. And I was so close to all the explosions that I think that if I was a millimeter or a few centimeters to the side, I probably would have either lost a limb or died. Now, at the time when I saw all the people, I thought they were all playing dead. Mm-hmm. I thought they were all passed out like I was. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that they were actually dead. And as the time goes by, I realize that there are only a few survivors. And I hear the moaning from the badly injured people that were still alive, but unfortunately didn't make it because no one could get to them on time. Mm-hmm. Blood pooled everywhere. And there was this acrid smell of burning flesh. It haunts me till this day. And I remember looking at some of my wounds, and I had these pieces of, or I didn't know what it was at the time, but there was like dirt on my leg. And I start like trying to clean it, and then I realize it wasn't dirt, it was burnt flesh from the pieces of shrapnel. Mm-hmm. We were sitting in that concrete shelter for another 7 hours, whispering words of encouragement to each other, until finally a civilian named Dayal walked in and asked, is anyone alive? And that's when I knew I was saved. I was finally saved. Out of 26 people in the concrete shelter, 5 were kidnapped to Gaza, 1 murdered in the tunnels. That was Hirsch Goldberg, Poland. 3 were... 1 was murdered on the way to Gaza when he jumped off the truck and tried to run away. 2 have been rescued in a hostage deal and are back in Israel. That's Or Levy and Elia Cohen. Elia Cohen, ever since, has took it upon himself to try to save the last survivor from the concrete shelter, Alon Ohel, who is still stuck underground in Gaza, waiting to be returned home to his family. Another 7 of us were rescued from that shelter back to Soroka Hospital in Be'er Sheva in Israel. And the rest lie dead in that concrete shelter.
Right.
2 of my very good friends were murdered there that day. Itai Banjo and Shani Kupelvaso. Now, Eyal comes and he calls his friends from a reserve military. They come, they pick us up, and we start driving towards Be'er Sheva. We were in a war zone. I remember coming out of the shelter, and the first thing that everyone told me was, stay low. There's still terrorists all over this area. And I remember bullets going over my head. And I remember the shooting and the explosions all over the place. We get in the cars and we start driving towards Soroka Hospital. The driver says, put your heads down and don't look out the windows. But I couldn't look away.
Mm-hmm.
The things I saw those that day can only be described in one word, and that's carnage. Burnt bodies on the side of the road, cars all over the place. Individuals my age who went to a music festival to have a good time, to let loose, to enjoy life, lie there dead. When we finally got to Soroka Hospital, I felt safe for the first time in what felt like forever. And that's when I saw the news. At the time, I thought that the terror attack that was happening was only to my friends and I in that concrete shelter. When I left, I saw it was a little bit wider. I thought that there are some terrorists, but not as many as there were. And when I saw the news, it's when it hit me. This horrible thing that happened to my friends and I happened to everyone in Israel. Not only in Israel, but that was the spark that started the war against Jews in the world. That was the spark that started the rapiding anti-Semitism that's going on this day.
It's impossible for me to wrap my head around, and for 2 years now, every day, my mind goes crazy thinking about the fact that Jews suffering and being the victims of this atrocious massacre turned the world against the Jews. In any other universe, it would have turned the people against Hamas. And by the way, the fact that Hamas live streamed it means that they were betting that the world would look at this and cheer them on. And that's the double sickness of everything that has happened. Do you, when you look back on your response of stepping up when Anel fell, what do you think inside of you? Because based on everything you've already told me, it sounds like that wasn't like your normal modus operandi. Obviously, it's not a situation you've ever been in, but something in you kicked in, some instinct that said, I am the one. And this is what I'm hearing over and over from you, that you are the one that was saved. You are the one who was chosen. You are the one who has to get this message across. You also said you were the one who was left there to die by Hamas, which is ironic because you were left there to live. You were left there with a mission. But it seems like this mission has come from somewhere unexpected. Where do you think it came from? And did your response surprise you at all? Or were you just going on instinct and nothing was really processing so much?
One thing that I really think is important to put out there is I was not the only one that threw grenades.
Yes.
It started with Anel, and I can't say exactly who from the survivors or the people that were murdered there threw grenades, but there were more. It wasn't just me and Anel.
Yeah.
It was a fight that we were all willing and we all needed to fight. Thinking back to that moment, I don't know if I would react the same today. I don't know how I would react today. I think anyone that tells you that they know how they would react in that situation is not being fully full, not being 100% truthful with himself. Mm-hmm. I think it was a fight or flight instinct, and for some reason, I chose to fight. I don't know if it's because I had nothing else to do, or I don't even know how I did it. I think it was some omnipotent power that I got. Something that someone that came down and gave me the strength to do this. And one thing that is important to put out there as well is I've never been able to speak to a crowd. I've never been able to get on a stage and talk to more than 20, 30 people. And ever since October 7th, it's in a way a gift that I got. I think that by living through that and being so close to a life-threatening situation and a near-death experience, it just triggered something inside of me. I don't know how or why these kind of things happen, but I feel a responsibility these days to do as much as I can. And I can say that I took this responsibility on myself after seeing other people doing it. One of the survivors from the concrete shelter is Ziva Bud, Elia Cohen's girlfriend, and they've been together forever, for 8 or 10 years, maybe even longer. Elia was kidnapped, and a few days after Ziv got out of the concrete shelter and also survived, she took it upon herself to rescue him and get him out of Gaza. And she made that happen. And now they're going all over the world and trying to save other hostages. Mm-hmm. And that is so honorable and so important that I just saw that happening, and I felt like I also needed to do it. And after Yariv Moser gave me the platform to share my story and to make a difference, I think that was the spark that really lit the fire inside of me that made me need to do this.
May I ask you a question about PTSD?
Yeah, of course.
from what I understand, and would make logical sense, I think, to anyone, the hardest hours would be between bedtime and waking up, when the unconscious takes over, because during the day we can distract, we can speak, we can dance. So, and if you're not comfortable, please tell me flat out, when you go to bed at night, through sleeping, and when you wake up in the morning, what are these three points in your typical day? How do you experience them?
I think that's the one thing that has become most difficult. And it's sad because I used to love sleeping. I think it was my passion in a way.
It's my passion for sure, yeah.
And I used to have wonderful dreams, and sometimes I could even control some of my dreams. I remember I was in my first year of my bachelor's degree in industrial engineering. And I loved calculus. I loved it. I just enjoyed numbers, and it was just so, I know people hate it, but it was fun for me. I used to spend hours learning everything and knowing how to do everything. And I remember one night I had this problem that I didn't know how to solve. And I go to sleep, and then I dream about the problem, and I figure out how to solve it. And I wake up, and I go and I solve it in the morning, like 5 minutes after I wake up.
You want to hear the craziest thing?
Yeah.
I had the same exact experience.
Yeah.
With calculus. Yeah. Same exact thing. I was working on it for hours. I couldn't sleep. Woke up with the answer.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So we share a lot of things in common. But that calculus problem, I wonder if it was the same problem.
Yeah, I think numbers just make more sense to me than words.
Yeah.
It's funny. But ever since the 7th October, sleeping has become a mission. Something, a fear that I have to overcome every night. Falling asleep is extremely difficult. Since the 7th of October, I have been prescribed medical marijuana to help me block out all the dreams and just to sleep. Which on one hand, it does help block out all the dreams, but on the other, you feel exhausted because you can't, it's not a real quality, like very high quality sleep. And in a way, I have to kind of make myself pass out every night because it's so hard to fall asleep. And I've been living with it. I've been learning how to live with it. It's not easy. I think any person with PTSD can connect to what I'm saying. But it's just become another part of life.
Does it get any easier?
No. I think in a way it's like getting older and your body just starts presenting new problems. And you just have to live with them and go on. And learn how to live life again. And it hasn't been easy, but I've been getting used to it.
What about waking up?
So one thing that has been helping me in general is sleep. I started doing martial arts ever since the 7th. I think a month after I decided that I need something that I'm passionate about, that I can focus and channel unhealthy energy into and come out stronger. Mm-hmm. And that's been helping my mental health. That's been helping me sleep at night. That helps me eat a healthier diet and live a healthier lifestyle. And I don't think I'd be here today without it, honestly.
Amazing. So you've got the coping skills that are helping you to wake up, to find purpose, use that purpose, and make it through your day in a meaningful way. And certainly, meaning changes everything. And I think that anybody who loses meaning in their life loses life itself. Do you have time for a few more questions? It's been an hour.
Yeah. We can do like another 15 minutes.
Okay. Let me ask this. So you had alluded to the rise in anti-Semitism, which perhaps most disturbingly to see it at Glastonbury and in Beyond Wonderland and actual musical festivals, where there's a complete lack of empathy and understanding of what actually unfolded that day. We also, I'd love to put myself in your generation. I'm twice your age. However, growing up in the constant shadow of the Holocaust, it's certainly a reminder for every generation of Jews that has come after World War II. I'm wondering, what do you think is the deeper significance of this moment in history?
I think all of us grew up with some relative from the Holocaust, some survivor. And I'm not sure, I think it was my grandparents and my parents that kept on saying, the world hates the Jews.
Right.
The second they have the chance, they'll go out and you'll see it. I didn't believe it, honestly. I didn't think that it was possible. I thought after the Holocaust, that's it, we're done. We went through the worst. And it's uphill from here. And I think in a way, the 7th of October was a wake-up call to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that wake-up call was very clear. Till this day, we're dealing with it. And we all understand that we're on our own.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, we're going to have to be able to protect ourselves. Now, because I've done martial arts, I think it boosted my confidence that I know that if I get into some kind of situation where I do need to protect myself, I'll be the best prepared that I can be. And I think all the Jewish people around the world need to get ready for the worst. And I'm not sure that it is behind us.
Sadly, I agree. And here in America, there are so many literally Jewish organizations training people with guns because the situation has become so dire. Where the safest place for a Jew right now is in Israel, even in the middle of a war. And that's an irony that I think cannot be understated. Has your faith or your relationship to God changed at all since experiencing what you experienced?
Most definitely. Ever since that day, I felt like I've created a new relationship, a new connection, a spiritual connection that I can feel. I don't always feel it. But it's there. And I can say that I grew up in a religious family. At a young age, I knew I wasn't going to be religious. I didn't feel any connection to God. And ever since the 7th of October, it's been a beautiful connection.
Amazing. What about your perspective of people and humanity in general? Has that shifted, or... How has this experience changed maybe your view of humanity before to today?
I feel like it brought the Jewish people closer to each other. People or Jews all over the world that knew that they were Jewish but didn't really identify as Jews, all of a sudden started coming to Jewish events and supporting Jews all over the world in any way possible. And unfortunately, those people, in a way, have been hunted. Their businesses are being destroyed, as you know. And that's sad. That's it really is sad. But it's also beautiful that it has brought the Jewish people together.
Yeah.
But in a way, it has created some kind of feeling of them against us, yes, where being Jewish this day, these days, labels you as a bad person for some reason. I don't understand why. I can't understand how a democracy in the Middle East is categorized as evil, and terror groups in the Middle East are categorized as freedom fighters. Freedom fighters don't use baby shields. They don't use civilians to protect themselves. They don't attack civilians. When an IDF soldier walks in or goes to Gaza, he's wearing a uniform. He doesn't have a mask on his face. He's not hiding his identity. He knows who he is. And he has a target on his back. But Hamas terrorists, they walk around in civilian clothes. They have masks on their face. And they will sacrifice their people to get the upper hand. And I don't understand how the world can't see that clear as day.
Sadly, I do think they see it clear as day, and that these are the double standards that apply to no one besides Jews. And the reason I say that is, name one group since the civil rights era, maybe, where anybody anywhere on earth openly called for death to a whole group of people. And the answer is, it doesn't exist. And we live in such an ultra sensitive time where people don't want to accidentally use the wrong pronoun, but they have no problem screaming for death to all Jews. And this is a real, it's mind-boggling, but it's a double standard that defies all other standards. And by even living in Israel, you are keeping the flame alive. You are protecting the Jewish future. As simple as that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to finish with one last question, and then if there's anything you want to add, you're welcome to. But my last question always is, what does Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
It's the most strongest thing that you can have as a Jew. It's the belief that we will always survive. And the Jewish people have been hunted forever. It's all over in all the history. If it's Girush Sfarad, where they kicked all the Jews out of Spain, or the Holocaust, or any other thing that happened to us, Am Yisrael Chai has always been this sentence that we kept on telling ourselves, that we have hope. We have hope, and now we have a homeland, which is Israel, which will welcome any Jew at any time. And I believe one day, I'm not sure when, but, and I hope it doesn't come to this, but that may be the only safe place for Jews in the world. And I'm happy that we have it.
We're blessed that we have it.
We are blessed.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Eitan, before we finish off?
I think every individual has the responsibility to try to help in any way possible. If it's donations, or if it's just going out there on social media and showing something that's actually true and fact-checking it and showing how and why it's true, that could help a lot.
Yeah. Facts matter and voices matter. And we all need to speak up together. For anybody who is watching, I encourage you, if you got something out of this and understand the call that he is making to share the voice, share the stories, keep these stories alive, because we cannot whitewash, we cannot deny what happened in Israel. Like, every country on earth has the right to live in a secure state in peace. War is something that nobody in Israel wants. Nobody in Israel wants. But sometimes war is something that is forced upon you the way that it was, in order to protect yourselves, to protect future generations, and to ensure, in this case, honestly, the future of the Jewish people. Eitan, thank you so much.
Thank you. And there's one last thing that's very important to add, that I got a little bit emotional from all of this. We need to bring the hostages home ASAP. Not tomorrow, not in a month, today. It should have happened yesterday. It should have happened months ago. They are stuck underground in terror tunnels, living in the worst conditions possible. And I'm afraid that if we don't save them, they may not make it. Do whatever you can to help them. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. And Am Yisrael Chai.
Am Yisrael Chai.
Thank you for tuning in.